the sixth episode of Tales for the East, a podcast series from Denniston, Sidehill and Haghill in Glasgow's East End. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Alistair Satchell and I'll be your host for this series. Today, I speak with Robert McCauley of Robert's Hair Design on Duke Street, Denniston. Robert was brought up in Sword Street and knows Denniston intimately. Our conversation goes into life in Denniston and Robert's youth, how he started his working life at the age of 9, memories of cinemas in the area, childhood holidays, the Denniston Pally and its roller disco days, roller hockey, the music scene of Glasgow in his younger days, and his professional life, and so much more besides. As we recorded this conversation over Zoom, there are, of course, the occasional sort of popping and weird noises, so I do apologise. I've tried to edit them out where possible, but you will hear a wee bit of odd Zoom noise as we go along. Without further ado, I hand you over to Robert McCauley. Who are you?
Well, I'm Robert McCauley, and I have a hair business salon on Duke Street, and I was born in Sword Street in Denniston. I'm brought up in Sword Street, spent most of my working life in Duke Street, you know, apart from about 9 years, but up until now, most of my working life I've spent in Duke Street. I know the area, I know the characters, I know the people in the shops that were here and the shops that are here now.
Whereabouts is Sword Street in relation to your the shop?
It's just 150 yards away. Sword Street comes out down off, as it comes down off Craig Park, and then over Duke Street, yeah, that's Sword Street. That runs down to the Yallagate. Well, it did run down to the Yallagate at one time. They put a barrier along it now.
Your folks, are they from Glasgow originally as well?
Not well. My mother's family was from Glasgow. My father's family from Bells Hill. But my father, they get bombed out during the war and ended up in Sword Street. And you had to take what kind of house you got. So they ended up in Sword Street in Denniston and just stayed there.
Wow. Did they ever talk about that at all? What the experience that was like?
They had an eight-bedroom boarding house just off the Manor Road. And they were trying to hit the power station, the Manor Power Station. And the Germans dropped a landmine on a parachute and it hit their house instead of the power station.
My God.
They were all in the house at the time as well, downstairs. Because the police, when my uncle turned up the next morning, he said, "You can't get across there. Everybody in that house is dead." And they weren't. None of them died.
That's amazing. So did they just flee?
They found you a house as quick as they possibly could. They were staying with a woman in Greenlees Road in Camas Line for a while. See, people with so many bedrooms had to take people or bombed out in. It was an obligation. If you had so many bedrooms and somebody got bombed out, you had to take them in. And then they ended up in Denniston and just stayed there.
So what did your folks do? What were their trades?
My father was a bus driver and my mother was just a housewife, but worked in a lot of shops as well. And she worked in Duke Street Hospital for a while as well, as an auxiliary.
Bus driving back when your dad, so that's kind of the 50s, was that when he started his career?
My dad passed his driving test. He actually never started a driving test in his life. Started working for the Lanarkshire Traction Company in 1928 and started driving in 1929. And they brought tests in 1933. But if you had been driving for 5 years before it, you didn't have to sit a test. Never drove buses to London, double deckers, never sat a test in his life.
Did he have a route or did he just go wherever?
My father's same route was Clyde Street to Mearnskirk. That was out in the south side. That was my father's route for 30 years, Clyde Street to Mearnskirk.
And how did he ever talk about it at all and sort of the routine and rhythm of it and the characters as well?
To be honest with you, no, he never, because I think a lot of bus drivers in those days, when the bus driver was locked in a cabin, it was a boring job. The bus driver wasn't the open buses we have now. The bus driver was in a cabin and the conductor or conductress was behind them and they never seen them until they got to the terminus. So he never really spoke about his work much, you know. But he was a company man, a total 100% company man.
It's quite extraordinary to do such a length of work now. It's extraordinary, yeah.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. He retired at 70 and started driving when he was 19 or something.
So, Sword Street, what was it like to grow up there? What were the kind of features of Sword Street?
The main feature in Sword Street was there was no cars.
Really?
There was one guy in the street who had a car and he thought he was Richie Rich. You know, there was nobody who had afforded cars then. It was, you were able to play rounders in the street and football in the middle of the street on summer nights, and there was no cars. There was no cars parked at all. There was sometimes cars come up and down, but very rarely. It wasn't, you know, the traffic would be during the day after 6 o'clock at night, and no traffic would go up and down. After the commercial traffic during the day, nobody had money for cars in those days.
No, no.
You know, that's the big difference in Denison on a whole, is that everywhere you go, you've got 6 inches between cars through right through every street in Denison now. But there was no cars before. It wasn't built for cars. Eventually, my father had a car in the 70s, but not before that. Because my father was a bus driver, he hated driving outside the work because he'd put a shift in. And if he had his summer's holiday, he would hire a big American, they called them shooting brakes, and a big Yankee car with the wood along the sides and take us away in that during the summer. But apart from that, he finished his shift and did not want to see another steering wheel again to the next shift.
Oh, totally. So getting out of the city then, where did you go for your holidays? Where would the adventure take you?
Croy Bay down at Ayrshire. We'd hire the car and we'd go away to different places every day. We never went to like a holiday. We'd go to different places, Barloch and places like that, and down to Ayr and Saltcoats and things like that for the day.
Where was the real treat? Was there anywhere that you were particularly fond of at all?
Probably Croy Bay, because you could drive the car onto the beach. You know, that was a good place to go. And you could have a whole day there, you know, and you could have a picnic out of the back of the car, you know. It's fantastic.
Which school did you go to then when you were...
I went to Thompson Street, which is the next street to Sword Street. So I only had a 100-yard walk to go to school.
Man. We talked to... In the first episode of the podcast series, we talked to Irene McInnes, who lives in that building now.
Oh, wow.
It's because she remembers going to school there and meeting her husband as a wee boy there, and they live in the headmaster's office now. That's their house. That's a nice link background. So, were you conscious of Reedvale Housing Association when it started then as well?
I was conscious of it because I had bought my very first house in Thompson Street.
Ah.
And then 131 Thompson Street. And it was only that would have been 1973. And that was the year they started getting round the doors, trying to drum up business for people to support a housing association. And one or two of my friends' parents were involved in it. A friend of mine, Bobby Somerville, his father, which knocked on all the doors, used to try and get people to say, "No, we want to improve the place. Are you up for it? You know, when you put your name down and say you're up for it, you know?" And Harriet Stromboli and people like that.
The notion of improvement seems to be the thing. And What was the area like growing up in as a child? It must have been, from all I've heard, it sounds fantastic.
Fantastic. Great. There was three summers in the area locally. There was one in Millicent Street, the Scotia. There's one in the Gallagate. The Orient at the bottom of my street. There was one in Armadale Street, the Parade. In fact, there was four. There was one in the Parade Cinema up at Meadow Park Street. So you had four cinemas. You had Alexander Park, which was a 10-minute walk. You had lots of swing parts, and then, as I say, there was no traffic on the roads after that night. So in the summer's nights, the streets were empty, and the kids used to be full of kids playing games in the streets, girls playing ropes and rounders, and yeah, it was a great place. Plus you were a 10-15 minute walk from George Square. That's a big asset, a major asset. You could walk into the city and back again.
Yeah. Totally. You
know, I have friends who grew up in the Schemes Leicester House, and there was no shops,
yeah,
no pubs, no cinemas, nothing. Yeah. It was like, you know, it was great. It was fantastic down here, you know. Although you didn't think so at the time, but later on you go, wow, what a good place to grow up, you know.
And do you have any fond memories of any particular, going to see any screening of anything in the cinema that made you go, oh, this is the best?
Well, as a kid, I went to see Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments. And it was, wow, you know, when the seas part, and it's like, because Cecil B. DeMille comes on and talks about it first. He was one of these directors. He wore the jodhpurs and the boots. And he would come on and go, you know, I'm Cecil B. DeMille. And, you know, I'm going to tell you about one of the greatest stories on earth, Moses and all that. You know, I was like, wow, this is fantastic. The Ten Commandments, whoa. And that itself gave me a kind of love for biblical epics, you know. I still like the biblical epics on TV, or Ben Hur's and all that stuff, you know. That kind of thing. Aye, lots of good movies. All those kind of things.
You talk about, when we chatted before, you talked about the Rendezvous Cafe as being somewhere that was of interest.
Well, that was the top of my street. So I had the best ice cream parlour in Glasgow, 30 yards away from the close I lived in. And there was no doubt, anybody could tell you, it was the best ice cream. There's no doubt about it. You know, I knew the Tignetti's personally. I knew the people who owned it. They stayed in Sword Street. I think they came from Barga in Italy. That's the place they have the fish supper thing every year. And Barga, because that many people from Barga came to Glasgow and opened chip shops. They have a fish and chip festival, a festival in Barga every year.
Amazing. Oh, fantastic.
So good fun.
What was the Rendezvous Cafe like? What can you describe it for us?
Well, I can. It was a very old-fashioned cafe. Very unique furniture, as you can see in the People's Palace, not the People's Palace and the Transport Museum. The furniture was very unique, but it was a cafe that only sold at night ice creams and hot orange. I mean, it didn't sell food or anything. You could get a Bovril and a cream cracker, but that was it. And they only opened the front half of the cafe during the week, and then a Sunday morning they opened the rest of it for the churchgoers. It would always, after church, it would always be really full. So it was a good cafe, and they sold the jarred sweeties, jars of sweeties. We put a quarter of this and a quarter of that, and soft drinks and cigarettes. It wasn't that. It was a good old fashioned cafe. You know, the mother and father were fantastic. The old ones, Mr. and Mrs. Tignetti, were very, very polite and nice. You know, when people started getting cars, you see them come down with a Pyrex bowl on a Sunday. They'd be queuing out the shop, and they get a Pyrex bowl filled ice cream, put a lid on it, and drive home because they liked. And they'd come down some steps in Ridley and Cantyne just to get their ice cream.
What was it, do you think, that made it so special? Was it the creaminess? Was it the sweetness?
It was a phenomenal ice cream. And all the rest of the cafes would have one of those little metal things and give you a ball of ice cream, and one of those things that gives you a square scoop. It gets ladled in and gave you about that much ice cream. There you go. They never measured their ice cream ever. It was just a big scoop. There you go. And it was about that size, you know. Fantastic.
Oh, so generous, yeah.
Absolutely.
Where were the other places you'd call highlights when you were growing up? What were the places you looked forward to going to, and where would you go for a date and all that sort of stuff?
Well, I was fortunate that when I turned just about 13 and a half, they turned the Denison Parley into a roller skating rink. So, and it was a very plush, very, very plush dance hall. And they just turned that overnight into a roller skating rink because they had a floor that was on springs in there. So it suited the roller skating. And they left the place the way it was. It was as plush as anything. Beautiful, stunning place. So that's where you go up there. And it was always full of girls and boys and really good music. Great place to go. Good place to grow up.
What kind of music were they playing there for the roller disco? Was it kind of Northern Soul stuff? Was it pop?
Oh, no, it was just the chart stuff. Top 20 chart stuff. There was a DJ called Dean Jeffries who ended up with a radio show. He was a popular DJ up the Pally.
Can you describe for us then, how did you get in, where did you get your boots in there? How's it laid out?
I had my own boots, but before I had my own boots, you would go in, you'd pay in the door, and you'd walk up the stairs. It would be three flights of velvet-covered carpet stairs to go up. I mean, you thought you were going into a palace, going up the stair. Then you would have a skate hire place, the skate hire room, and you would, before you had your own skates, you always tried to get the same number because you knew a good pair of skates. I have 112, and you know they try and give you that number. And if they saw you, say, "I'll keep your skates for you," so you always got a good pair. And then you just get to put them on. There's a room for putting them on, which always smelt kind of like dirty socks and leather, you know, because it probably was. And then you went out and skating. And it started about 7:30 to 10:30. It was fantastic. It was really good. Really, really. And a great place for keeping you off the street. I kept a lot of people out of trouble. A lot of people. Because in the 60s, it was quite rough about here at times. It could get rough at night.
What do you think the cause of that was?
It was gangs. There was a gang called structure in Glasgow then, that every area had its own gang, you know.
Now the Tongs and so on, yeah.
Absolutely, I knew them all. I knew all those guys, the Tongs. And it was just a way of life for some kids. I never really participated in it that much, you know, because you can, we were more interested in music girls than beating people up, you know.
What do you think it was about gang culture that appealed to these folk? Was it the togetherness or what?
Camaraderie, working class camaraderie. They came out of homes that were quite poor. And there was nothing, there was no expectation of it getting any better. So you hung a bit with your mates, you know, and got up to some mischief, you know. That was it. And you were somebody, if a guy came from down the road, it was somebody else to take your vent your frustration on somebody from another district, and they would do the same. It was just a total, it was definitely to do with the working class and the, I don't know how you'd call it, social economics in the place. I mean, a lot of people in the Carlton where the Tongs came from, a lot of poor people. I mean, a lot of poor people in Denison too. It went from above Duke Street was good, middle class, below Duke Street where we were was working class, below Gallagate was very working class. So that's kind of the way it was, you know.
About music, when did music start in your life?
Well, you're going to ask me about girls. I'm not going to tell you about girls.
Tell me about your winching.
No, first started getting, the good thing about Ross getting they played all the chart stuff, so you were getting it, because in those days that was just the pre-Radio Luxembourg, and all the good stations were pirate stations like Radio Scotland. To listen to pirate stations in Luxembourg on a Sunday night to the top 20. There was none of that before radio started getting Radio 1 and Top of the Pops and all that stuff. They'd go up to the Denison Pal and go roller skating, and you'd hear all the top 20 stuff. You know, the Kinks and the Beatles, the Troggs, you know, Fleetwood Mac, all that kind of stuff. So that gave you an interest in music. And sometimes you would say, and then somebody would say, oh, I've got a guitar, and then somebody, oh, I'll get a wee band together, and things like that. And that started a lot up in Denison, you know.
When did you actually start to play music yourself? When was it that you first got into it?
I got a drum kit at 15 out of McCormick's, which wasn't very good, because we stayed in that room and kitchen, and the drum kit took up quite a bit of the living room, you know. I started at 15 drumming, and then I done it, and I wasn't that successful until... I gave it up, actually, in my late teens. And then I played hockey up until I was 45. And when I quit the hockey, I went back to the drums very seriously.
Where did you play hockey?
I played the roller hockey for Glasgow Roller Hockey Team. And we trained in St Mungo's, just off the Gallagher, St Mungo's School, Hull. Oh. But we were in the Yorkshire and Humberside League. So when we played, we had to play down south. And roller hockey in England is a big sport. And it's nothing like ice hockey. There's no protection. It's a non-contact sport. It's a very skillful sport. So in Scotland, we were on teams, so we had to travel down to England, to Yorkshire and Humberside to play.
There were no other teams in Scotland at all?
No, there was not. There were some roller hockey teams that was just the same as ice hockey, only played with a ball and roller skates. But that was the one we played was English League roller hockey. But it was a non-contact sport.
So how did that come about? How did roller hockey make its way to the Gallagher?
Well, it came from a guy from Spain, a guy called Juan Renau. He married a girl from Cadmile in Glasgow. And Juan had played, Juan's father had run the team in Alicante. He started in Cadmile in Glasgow, out in the East End. He started a team and a lot of young boys started playing. And that's how it grew here. Just through one Spanish guy, because he was a phenomenal player. But one of the guys who played for the team came from down in Bridgeton, Paul Kelly, and he ended up playing for Alicante through it. And that was a full-time job in Spain playing roller hockey, you know. So they gave him an apprenticeship in a garage as a mechanic to go over there. And he went over there, and he owns a garage now.
That's fantastic. That's, yeah. Amazing the way these things go. So you come back to music. Where did you play your gigs when you were younger?
I never played gigs when I was younger. I used to went to see gigs. I never played an actual gigging band when I was younger. I used to be rehearsed, but never actually played anywhere. It wasn't until later in life I took it seriously and I started gigging a lot.
So how did that feel then, that your first gig after having given up and then going, here we go. How did that feel to be the man behind the sticks?
Panic stricken. Even though you've rehearsed it, you're still panic stricken. Which I'm not, and that was 23 years ago, you know, so I've done hundreds of gigs since then.
Yeah. And what sort of music do you play?
I'm a blues guy, you know. Mm. I like blues and rock, but we play in pubs, a bit of rock, a bit of pop, a bit of blues. There's always pub standards I've got to play them as well, you know, All Right Now and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Knowing that obviously your present band is the best band you've ever been in because of politics, but what would you say, apart from your current band and the current lineup, which has been the best band that you've played with, and what did it feel like when it was just at the top of its game?
I played with an English guy called Steve Green, and he was a kind of total blues enthusiast, and we used to play at Dundee Blues Festival. And that was a real good experience, you know, because Steve he's an encyclopedia knowledge of blues music. And you would ask him about some obscure blues song, and he'd tell you who recorded it, who wrote it, and how far it went up the charts and all that stuff. I don't know where he got it. It was in his mind. But it was a joy to play with him because he played. There was only three of us in that band. It was a great wee band. We played all over the place with him.
Yeah. Melodic blues is just, I'm a huge fan of Peter Green.
Well, that's my hero.
Yeah,
that was the first big band I ever seen.
Really?
Yeah.
So with Peter Green?
Fleetwood Mac be Peter Green and Green's Playhouse. And the only reason I went, to be honest with you, because I fancied a girl that fancied Peter Green. And I knew if I said, well, do you want to go and see Fleetwood Mac, she would go. You know, because at that time he was quite an iconic person. A lot of women.
With lovely curly hair.
That's right.
He was great.
There was a Liverpool band called the Sleaze Band on that night with him. I remember that. One of my mates is still getting the actual ticket for that night, believe it or not.
Whoa.
And I think that was '69.
So that's Oh Well and all that was out by that point.
That stuff, right.
What were the other big bands you saw that, or small bands? What were the bands that really marked you when you were younger?
One of the ones that marked me when I was young. Now, a lot of the good Glasgow bands, but a lot of great Glasgow bands. But one of the bands I used to see up the Electric Gardens, we saw them quite a lot, was a band called Heir Apparent. The word Heir as in Heir Island. We're an Irish band called Heir Apparent. And they were Hendrix's support band on his European tours. They were fantastic. They were a great band. A really great band. Slade as well. Slade used to come to Glasgow when they were Bother Boys, and by they put on a show, they gave you a show. You know, you left and going, wow, that was a good gig, you know. You know, and this Chicken Shack, the bands like that, Stan Webb's Chicken Shack. So a lot of the rock was progressive rock was blues-based, you know. Family, I've seen Family a good few times, you know. They were fantastic. Never liked Yes or Genesis, to be honest with you. I don't know why. And I never ever liked Queen, you know. I think it was when you went to S concerts or the prog concerts. There was no lassies. So if you're going looking for a lassie, there wasn't any there. So guys be like long hair bobbing up and down, you know.
Beards, yeah.
There's all the women about here, mate, you know.
So where was the enjoyable place to go and see a band
Electric Gardens, Circuit Hall Street, which is now the garage. They had different bands on every week. There was a circuit of bands in the UK, and you'd have Status Quo 1 week, Slade the next, Heir Apparent, Rare Bird, and then you'd have the Glasgow bands every other week as well. There was a lot of really phenomenal bands going about, you know.
Who were the Glasgow bands that you were fond of?
The Poets. The Dream Police, they were fantastic. What do you call them? The one that was before Alex Harvey Band.
Tear Gas. Bloody brilliant.
I used to love Tear Gas. Big Dave Batchelor was a great front man, you know. All those bands like that. There's a lot of great bands.
Yeah. What about what was he called? Frankie
Miller.
Yeah. Did you ever see Frankie Miller?
Yes, I did actually. He used to play with the
Stooges.
He played with a band with Stooges. Well, I've got to say, if you're a Glaswegian and you don't like Frankie Miller, there's something up with you. You know, there's definitely something up if you don't like Frankie Miller and you're a Glaswegian. Otis Redding's wife said that Frankie Miller was the best white soul singer she ever seen. There you go. Which is a good compliment. A good compliment. His version of the old Kitty Lester song, Love Letters Straight From Your Heart, when he wrapped it up a bit, is a phenomenal song, you know. I like Frankie Miller. What a great artist, then. Although, I had one of my friends was a drummer with Alex Harvey Band. He died 2 years ago. And he was around then playing with all these bands and gigging with them and doing the same gigs. And I said, who was the best band of that era, do you think? And he said, Dean Ford and the Gaylords, who then became Marmalade. He said Dean Ford was the best singer he ever heard. Although a lot of the bands would try and finish their gig, wherever they were, in Ayrshire or Airdrie or outside Glasgow, and try and get into Glasgow to the Picasso at 11 o'clock on a Saturday night to watch the Pathfinders.
Oh.
They were the band's band. They were the band that all the bands wanted to see.
Wow.
I was about 2 or 3 years younger than that then. I couldn't go, you know. But I've got some friends who were full-time musicians then, and they gave me the SP and what was going on then, you know.
Let's now come on to your working life. Yeah. So when you were younger, did you think, right, I need to get a trade, or what did you think? Did you want to be an astronaut?
I started working at 9.
Oh, my God, what doing?
In a laundrette just across the road there. It was a laundrette. A girl called Nancy McDonald owned it in Belfield Street. That's in two streets up to Sword Street. And Nancy McDonald's a friend of my sister's, and she was looking for somebody to deliver her laundry after school. And my sister says it was 2 and 6 months a week, and you delivered 4 or 5 people's laundry after school, and I was 9. And I've never been without a job since. I delivered messages for the co-op, I've done paper runs, van boy on a Saturday morning, anything to get money, because your parents didn't have money to give you then. There was no money your parents could give you any more than maybe about 2 bob for your pocket money. If you wanted to buy a pair of Wranglers or buy a new suit, you'd save up for it off your own money. And that's how it went.
What was your favourite of your early jobs then? Was there anyone in particular?
I worked at the co-op. I was a delivery boy for the co-op. Unfortunately, all the deliveries were up Craig Park in West of Craigs, which are quite steep hills to the big house up there. You'd have a wheelbarrow with egg boxes full of groceries and try and push it up the hill, you know. That was my favourite job because it was 30 shillings a week, and that was just after school. So that allowed me, I could pay up, I made to measure suit and I paid it up off that money. And I bought my first pair of Levi's in Wranglers, so they were actually Wranglers that were 52 and 6, so off of that money as well.
Amazing.
So, them good old days.
So your working life progressed, and how did you find your trade then? What took you to?
Well, when I left school, I was having trouble fitting into a trade. And I was on the Gallagate one day, and my mother met this old friend of my grandfather's, Joe Gurley. And she said, now the boy's looking for a trade. And he got me a job as an apprentice plumber. I was 15. So I'd done that for a year and a half. And then I'd wanted to be a hairdresser when I left school. But at that time, you had to pay the salon £100 as a bond to do your apprenticeship. And my mother,
that's huge.
My mother and father... That was like maybe £1,000 now.
Yeah.
My mother and father did not have that kind of money then. So I'd done the plumbing thing, and I got to about nearly 17, and there was the opportunity to go to hairdressing college at that age, because people left school at 15, but you never went to college till you were maybe 17 or something then. So I'd done a 2-year course at Glasgow Central College of Commerce for 2 years, which was good.
Where did that take you then? Did you get a place that, were you working with someone after that, or was it you straight onto your own?
The good thing that I had known from working before school is that if you want to learn anything, you've got to stick in it. So although I went to college, I worked in a salon on a Saturday every week. And a lot of the students in the college didn't do that, for God knows why. Mm. It gave you phenomenal experience. And so about... two-thirds through the way through the course, a London company were interviewing for apprentices in Baker Street in London, and I brassed my case, and I got the job. And the guy who ran the college then was a guy called Tony Ventilla. And I said, Tony, I've got a chance at a job here in London. And he said, well, you go to that job and you stick in and I'll mark you in every day to college. I'll mark you in every day as long as you can back up and sit your sitting guilds. And that means you'll still get your bursary.
Amazing.
Because it was quite a big deal for one of their students to get a job in this salon in Baker Street. Because the clientele in that salon was like, you know, like, Mickey Finn, a T-Rex's girlfriend and all that kind of stuff. There was a lot of well-known people coming in that shop, you know. The guy that produced Love Story, his wife used to come in, you know. It was a flashy salon. So it was a big deal for one of their students to get a job in there, you know. And it was just totally brass my case. Sometimes you've just got to say, well, I can do that. Well, I'll be able to do that. No problem. I can do that.
So how did you like London then in comparison to Denniston?
Well, I loved it. I was staying with three girls. Two of them I knew from Denniston. And I get £6 a week wages in the salon. And my digs was £4.
Ooh.
For the girls, so I was left with £2. And then my tube fare for Bounds Green to Baker Street every day was £1.80 for a weekly pass. So I was left with £20. But the tips in that salon were phenomenal. You'd get £4 or £5 a day in the salon in tips.
Brilliant.
So it was really good. And they sent me to Sassoon School. And I learned, in the time I was with Jingles, it's called Jingles, the salon, I learned so much. So much. I would do it again for £6 if I had learned the same again, you know.
Yeah, that's amazing. And what about Sassoons then? What was that like studying there?
They sent me a 6-week course to Sassoons. I actually met Vidal Sassoon there, believe it or not. He came there. He was supposed to come the Wednesday and never turned up. The place was like a bomb site the next day, and he walked in a white suit. He had a white suit on, you know. And he came over and said, he asked me where I was from. I said, Glasgow. And he said, I don't know Glasgow very well. Because he was my kind of hero at the time, you know. The hairdresser's hairdresser.
So what was it about hairdressing that drew you in and then has kept you all these years?
At school, I was pretty creative at art and things like that. And I think that's what it is. It's a creative job. And I think that's what drawn me and kept me in it. I think that I didn't like school at all. I wasn't mathematically or chemistry minded, but I was good. I was artistically minded.
Yeah.
I was always good at making up stories in English and good essays and good at my artwork. I always get sent every year to represent the school in the art galleries and the competitions. Not that I've ever, oh, you actually wonder why I was going, but they must have seen something there in me. They sent two people for every year. So there was 8 or 10 years when.
Amazing.
A guy in my class won the gold medal that year. And he couldn't go to school to pick up because he had no shoes. That's a bad one, isn't it?
Aye. Yeah.
That's a bad one. Yeah. Creative genius. His mother and father wouldn't let him stay on at school because they needed the money. Some people get a shit life, man.
No, there's no two ways about it. Not easy at all. So, coming back to Glasgow, then you got your training. Where did you go, and what were the first steps you made to owning your own salon?
Well, I had always that in my mind. That was in the back of my mind all the time. I'm wanting to have my own business. I want to try and lift myself out of this room and kitchen mentality, you know. And I went and I would work for the people I thought who were good hairdressers, and I would work with them, and then move on to somebody else who I thought was a good hairdresser and work in their salon as well. Not the best way to do it, and maybe not the nicest way to do it, but I was a bit mercenary. I wanted to learn from the best people and learn all the best techniques. So I would work for 6 months for somebody and then go a year for somebody else. So by the time I was about 23, 24, I had my own place. And I had worked for a lot of really good hairdressers, you know.
So what did that feel like to have your own business, your own place, your own shop?
My first wee shop was in Duke Street. It was like great. It was fantastic, wasn't it? It was great, you know. I'm getting the money. And it's not just that, you know. Said, you know, I'm doing well. That wee feeling, I'm doing well in life, you know. Aye, it's a good feeling.
Do you remember your first customer as well that came in through the door?
No, I don't. Although I still, there's a guy I done last week and I've been doing his hair for 40 years.
That's phenomenal. Amazing. So how did, well, that, this is a technical question then. How does a customer's head and hair and all that change over 40 years?
You know, their hair gets thinner and less of it. That's obvious, you know. That's just the way it goes. My female customers, some of their hair's still quite good, but the guys that have been doing for a long time had really great hair years ago, and it's not so great now, you know. And that's just life, isn't it? That's just the way it is. But some of my female customers, older customers, have got fantastic hair still.
Mary Binney, who I was seeing to put me in contact, or give me your shop email. It's Emma does her hair for her.
Mary's I've done Mary's hair for years before Emma. Mary's got great hair. I wish I'd half of Mary's hair, to be honest with you. You know, she's got phenomenal hair. Plus, she's a good laugh as well.
This is one of the things I'm always fascinated by with when I speak to barbers, like when I'm in, you know, in the city.
I'm not a barber, I'm a ladies' hairdresser, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Like that intimate relationship between the hairdresser and the client it's really something. Like, so what is that like? Do you remember?
Listen,
everyone,
the client comes in the first time you see her, and if you give her a good job, you do a good job for her the first time. Because the women are looking for a regular hairdresser, and they come into my salon first time because they weren't pleased where they went before. And my job is to try and please them and give them what they want. It's all in the consultation, asking them what they want and what they like. A lot of hairdressers just do what they like, okay, and fire in. You've got to know what it's the customer's needs. It's a business. It's not my needs. It's the customer's needs. It's not my ego. A lot of hairdressers go ego trips. I will do what I want. No, you're doing the customer's the most important person in the salon. She's the one that's calling the shots. Without her, there's no money in the till. It's easy peasy. But I can't understand a lot of hairdressers, and they'll tell the client what to do. You know what I would tell them to do, you know? It's all about women are looking for a confidant in the, with her hair. I'm looking for someone that they can come to every time, and you go, I'll be able to please you, because I know the best thing you can know about a client is what they don't like. Then you won't do it to them. Get you what they don't want. That's the first thing. What do you not like? I don't like this and I don't like that. Well, make sure we don't give you that. My job's easy now because I've been doing it for 50 years, but it wasn't easy when I was in my 20s, you know.
And how did your business grow? Who was the first member of staff that you brought on?
I brought on a wee guy from Denison, actually, a wee guy called Billy Hadifin. He's dead now, he's dead, Billy. And a couple of local girls that went to White House School as apprentices came in, and they were great, aye.
You're kind of at the hub of people coming in with their stories. And are there any kind of characters that stick out from
hundreds? You wouldn't believe the stories I hear in here. You wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe it.
Are there any you could share with us?
No, I'm not going to share because they're confidential. They're confidential. Confidential.
Confidential. That's perfect.
It's known because people tell you things. But every day I've got a big double window, and every week, something or somebody walks past and you'll go, my God, that's the maddest thing I've ever seen. And then the next week you'll go, no, it's no, that's the maddest thing. I mean, like 3 years ago, hot summer day, girl walked past the shop door, big bubble windows, with a bikini and high heels down Duke Street. You go, what's going on here, man? You know, what happened there? Aye, it's like, aye. Things like that, you know. My clients tell me confidential stories. A lot of them are really funny, and a lot of them can be sad as well, you know.
I guess that's the relationship, though, is that it's a confidence.
Absolutely. They'll tell you things they won't tell their husband, and I'm telling you that. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So you just learn to take what they say and not tell anybody about it, you know. And they're hoping you're going to be a confidant, and that's where I've got to be.
When you were growing up in Denniston, who were the significant characters around, and what was that? Who, you know, who were the people that you remember?
One of the biggest significant characters is a guy who owned a snooker hall on Hill Foot Street. It was a guy called Dan McFarlane. And they never called, it was called Snooker and Billiards Hall, but everybody just called it Dance. And he was a major character, a major, major character. Furry, funny, witty guy, you know, very, very cheeky. That sarcastic Glaswegian humour, you know. He was a major character in Denison. And every, all the school, he would dog school and go and play snooker and dance. Everybody done the dog school and go for a game of snooker in the afternoon, you know. And you just listen to his part. He was really, really funny, you know, but very sarky and witty, you know. And that was a place when your mother would say, don't you dare go to that snooker hall. Because it was, you know, it was a den of iniquity, you know. Don't go to that snooker hall. There's bad people in there, you know. And now you're sending your kids up to snooker hall, see if they get on pot black or something, you know. There was local characters in every street, you know, but a lot of them would, the pattern between them wasn't that much different. They were all kind of had the individual pattern in their ways. There was tough guys and there was nice guys. And, you know, you learn to negotiate your way through the characters by who's a tough guy and who's not a tough guy, you know.
You learn your way.
Absolutely. You grow up and you just learn, watch and learn. Watch the street. You were out in the streets. Because kids didn't stay in the house and watch the telly then. Nobody was on an Xbox. Ladies. You're outside till your mother shouted you up. And even then, you tried to stay out another 15 minutes. You know? So you negotiated the streets as a kid. You learned on the streets, which is the best way, I think, to learn, you know?
One of the first times I'd heard mention of yourself was through Facebook and the Denison information page. And you had the fantastic post about all the shops on the street and how it's changed over the years. What can you give us a quick rundown of the shops that you remember from your youth and how that's changed to now as well?
Well, I remember the grocery shops were before the advent of supermarkets were the important ones, like Cochrane's, Galbraith's, Lipton's, Sir Thomas Lipton's, and the Co-op. There was a big dairy in Denison. One of the things then was all these places delivered messages. They delivered them. So I was employed as a cooperative boy. My mate worked for Cochrane's. My other mate worked for Gobrace, he had a bike, and my mate Jack Gofeather, he had a bike as well. And round the corner in Fraser's Dairy, everybody above Duke Street in the drives in got their milk delivered and their rolls delivered. That was everybody. You'd get your milk and your clothes and your half a dozen rolls in the morning. So they employed a multitude of schoolboys up there at 6:30 in the morning delivering milk. That was one of the notable things, that people got their stuff delivered. And that people would go out every day to do a daily shop. They wouldn't go to the supermarket and buy. There was no supermarkets. Nobody would go and buy a weekly shop. Women had message bags. You must have seen them yourself, the old message bags. And they would put their £3 of potatoes. We'd buy £3 of potatoes and a quarter of roast beef or a quarter of, you know, a tin of corned beef or something. And then that was the dinner for the day. And the next day they would go out and buy the dinner for that day. And then supermarkets just ruined it. You know, there's no, you walk into a supermarket, you don't know anybody of the people that works in it. When you walked into a local shop, it's be, hi, Tommy, how are you doing yourself? How are you doing, Robert? How's your mum keeping? You were getting that in the shops. Aye, no, that's nice. That's a nice thing. You know, rather than being an anonymous person in a super, you're anonymous. When in the wee local shop, everybody, my mother would say to my dad, Jimmy, do you want to come a wee walk along Duke Street to do the messages? My dad would say, no, he says, you're there for about 2 hours. He says, you stop every 50 yards and talk to somebody for half an hour, you know? And that was the way the women got gagged. They would learn all the gossip in the street when they were out for the messages. But now everybody's, or the kids are stuck in with Xboxes, or their wives are working. The kids, you know, don't really know what it's like to get in a normal shop, except then there's no supermarkets. We buy everything in the one place, you know? I'm starting to sound like an old fool, you know?
That's perfectly fine. You said when we spoke as well that the nature of shopping in Denison has changed so much. How has the shopping in Denison changed now?
Well, and there's no grocers here anymore. You couldn't get by. Oh, there's a couple of little Asian shops, right? But they're not the same as the shops that used to be there. You can't go and buy a pair of jeans in Duke Street. You can't buy a pair of shoes. There was 5 shoe shops in Duke Street then. Mm-hmm. You can't buy a pair of shoes. Couldn't even buy a pair of socks in Duke Street now. So it's all coffee shops, hairdressers, barbers, charity shops, and pubs. And like, they're starting to get a couple of restaurants, which was good. Coy's restaurant was the most innovative thing that ever happened to Denison. It was the most innovative thing that ever happened. But unfortunately, people moan about it. They go, it's a trumped-up cafe. You say, well, I'm sorry. He's got 5 full-time chefs in there. And he can't give you lasagna for £3 when he's got 5 full-time chefs to pay. He's got to charge the same prices as they do in town. They moaned and moaned for years. There's not a restaurant. Then you give them a nice restaurant and they start moaning again. You know, that's just human nature, I suppose. But yeah, that's a big difference now. They've got a couple of restaurants. Yeah. But apart from that, you couldn't buy, what are you going to buy in Duke Street? Like an ice cream? One of these fancy ice cream shops or a latte or something, a fancy coffee. There's nothing else to buy. I don't think there's even a fruit shop here now. Used to be, the place was inundated with fruit shops at one time, you know, with fresh fruit daily. One of the only people that does is the flower shop. I mean, she's getting her fresh flowers every day, and that's phenomenal. That's great. She's done here every day, you know. I think it's just grown with the times, I suppose, you know. Most high streets have went that way. More's a pity, I say, you know, because Tesco and Asda want to rule the world. You know, they're not leaving anything for the wee individual entrepreneur. He's know that he can't get a shot at it anymore. Yeah. You know,
that's the nature of capitalism, isn't it? Just kind of
absolutely.
Community is kind of one of the things that keeps coming back again and again in this as well. How would you say that the community of Denniston has grown over the years? What does it feel like? Because the population's changed so much with so many people coming in from elsewhere, and there was always people coming in from elsewhere as well in Denniston. But why has that changed, and how does it make it feel?
It's getting better, actually. A lot of the younger people moving in here now who have started up things like a Denniston information page. I've got friends in Australia who are in that, and friends in Canada who are on that page that used to live here and love it. Things like that. The young people come in now and they're trying, I mean, like I say, during the lockdown there, was people organising street cleanups, you know, and going up to Alexander Park and cleaning up. You know, and that was a phenomenon. People didn't do that before. A lot of the young people said, well, we're in Denniston and we like it.
Yeah.
It's the alternative to the West End. This is now the wee alternative to the West End. You know, when the lockdown's not there, they've got some nice pubs and stuff to go to. Aye, they seem to be a wee pride in Denniston that has not been about for a long time. A long, long time. And it's like, the young people are doing it. And you'll see some, you know, maybe somebody from Romania or something going, oh, I love Denniston. And you go, what? How do you, you know? And they do. They generally think it's a great place to stay. It's like, it is a good community now, I think. I lost it for a wee while. I lost it in the 70s and 80s a wee bit, and maybe the mid-90s, and it's starting to come back again, which is good, I think.
That's phenomenal.
But they seem to have a wee sense of pride and come from Denniston now. And it's still that place where you would maybe get your first flat before you moved on to your semi in the suburbs, which is good. Aye, it's good to see that wee local pride. I don't live in Denniston anymore. I live outside Denniston, but I mean, I'm in every day at work. So I still feel myself a Dennistonian, even though I don't stay here, because I'm in here. And I walk down the street and I know everybody that's worth, knowing, but I know people, lots of people. And a good thing is that people talk to you about here. It's a chatty place. They'll start talking to you, and I like that. It's a Glaswegian thing, you know. I bumped into a girl yesterday, and I had the Primal Scream Screamadelica black T-shirt on. And she said, and I didn't even know, she said, see that T-shirt you've got on? She stopped me in the street. It's that T-shirt. That was a black T-shirt, was when they done the Screamadelica second tour. That's what the black was from. I said, there you go, thanks, there you go. And we started talking to her, where she was from, and chatting away. She was from Drossen, and we started chatting away, and that was good. And I said, nice to meet you, bye. And I never met her, never didn't know if you had them before it. That's a good thing. That's got to be a good thing, you know, than sitting somewhere where people are staring at each other, you know, staring at each other and don't talk. I mean, I lived in a country one time when I got, and it was Australia. When I used to get a bus to work every morning, nobody spoke. Nobody spoke to each other. But in Glasgow, even if you don't know somebody, you go, oh, some weather, eh? No, start the next minute, you go, well, where do you come for yourself, son? You say, oh, my Auntie Jeannie stays up there. And the whole conversation, then other people start getting in it, and the whole three or four people on the bus are talking. You know, when you go off your destination, you're a bit sorry because you've left some newfound pals, you know. Stuff like that.
I love Glasgow. It's genuinely is my favourite city in the world, and that's why I'm so chuffed to get to do this. You know, it's amazing.
I used to hope some things that are happening there, with things that happen, that they don't change that. People are trying in places, I'm not going to say who or when, to change that sarcastic Glasgow sense of humour.
Some
dire thing will happen in life, and somebody will crack a joke about it, and the next day you'll go, my God, where did you get that from, you know? But that's Glasgow, you know, they think that's funny.
Well,
it's
like the Rod Hull, the score was 2-1, by the way, you know?
aye, that kind of thing. Aye.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Just a wee thing you were talking about the market and Market Square. I had a great aunt who was, when she was 12, they used to sell 12-year-old girls to farmers for 6 months in the early 1900s. They called it feeing out. She was feed out to a farmer for 6 months when she was 12 years old for £5. My mother's auntie stayed in the Gallagher. They would inspect you, animals would clench your teeth and check their muscles and all that. And she had to sleep in a barn and dump clogging Ayrshire in the farm in Ayrshire. That's an odd thing, isn't it? You tell kids that and they don't know what?
Yeah.
He sold you for a fiver for 6 months so your father can go in the bevy.
That was the tail end of the bondagers. That was the bondage girls, the indentured labour. Well, that's great, Robert. Thank you. Is there anything else you want to say at all? Anything?
Nothing really. And just that, you know, the fact that we're predominantly talking about Denison and this, it's getting better again.
That's amazing.
It's getting better. And it's not the shops that I wrote down that are missing that's making. There's no comeback of that. That's not going to come back.
No.
It's the people that are moving in. The young folk have got pride about the place now, which is brilliant. You know, most of them not from Denison, not born and bred here, and coming in and saying, well, this is, you know, I'm going to make this place my home and I'm going to get in the community, which is fantastic. It really is good. Really is good. And that's what's going to keep Denison good. That and Robert's design and duty.
Thank you so much, Robert. It was just brilliant to get the opportunity to talk with you and hear your tales. It's clear that you've got such a passion for and a knowledge of the area. I'm so chuffed that we got this time together to have a chat. Thank you to Gail and Alison at Floristers on Duke Street and Mary Binney for putting me in contact with Robert. I really appreciate that. Tales for the East is an artist-in-residence project from Glasgow Life. I share the position with my mate Tim Morozzo, who will be taking photo portraits of the people we speak to when COVID restrictions lift, and we're hoping to do an exhibition in the streets, which we'll say more about in the future. There's already 5 episodes of this podcast out and about, so if you want to listen to them, please feel free. There's so many more tales to be told, so if you know someone who knows tales of Denniston, Sighthill or Haghill, and you think they'd be willing to talk to us for the podcast, we'd love to hear from them. I'm particularly keen to speak to folk from Haghill, as we've not really spoken to anyone from there yet. And I'd also love to speak to anyone from the diverse immigrant communities in the area. So please do drop us a line on info@tales-fae-the-east.com with any contacts that you think would be willing to talk. We're also on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Our website, tales-fae-the-east.com, gives you some more info about the project and an intro to both Tim and I, and provides links to the subjects covered in the episodes. With this residency, we're very soon going to be offering photography and podcasting workshops, so please do feel free to drop us a line to say if you'd like to join us. We'll advertise these as we go along on social media, so you'll know where to go, but they'll be on Zoom, so anyone can come along. One of the subjects we're particularly interested in investigating is the role of Gaelic in the community. If you are a Gaelic speaker in the area, we'd love to talk to you. Or, alternatively, if you know of any interesting Gaelic-related stories or facts about the areas, we'd also be really keen to hear them. There's so much more to find out, so do keep your eye on the podcast feed for the next episode. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please feel free to like us or leave a review on whichever platform you use to listen. That would be great. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to seeing you again soon. Moerintang. Himirishchev. See you again. Tatibai!